The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The Kabbalah expresses existence as a light, a divine light. Remember, this is not a philosophy, but this is a conceptualization of how the Jew encounters reality. And that would be conceptualized as a divine light. When God wanted to create the world, He caused a tzimtzum, a withdrawal from the light, from the center of the light, creating a vacuum. This is the beginning of space. Right? And the tzimtzum is the greatest manifestation of the almightiness of the divine. Nothing can restrain the divine, nothing can confine the divine except the divine Himself. If God wants to give place and space to a creature who is other than God, then God can do that. So God creates a place and space for there to evolve a being other than God, a human being. And the metaphor for the human being is vessels, right? Finite vessels, vessels that are very different than light. And the divine then projects a thin ray of infinite light to the vessels, causing the vessels to break, which is talking about the idea, or expressing the idea, that God is going to give of Himself to another. That the gift that God gives man is the possibility to be close to God, to be one with God, and yet not become God. Upon the contact of the light with the vessels break. There is some kind of breakdown. This is the mystical Big Bang theory, right? Something breaks down. And we've already developed, what does that mean? How does Judaism understand some kind of original breakdown, some kind of original chaos? And how could chaos be included within the expression and the revelation of God? But there was a piece in the story, I mean, there's a number of pieces in the story I haven't told you. But now I'm going to tell you just a little bit more. We had talked about the fact that 10 vessels were created. 10 independent vessels. And when the divine projected His infinite light into the vessels, they broke down. And that's to be expected if you took a vessel and you put into it more than it can handle. So it explodes, right? I found that out when I bought a popcorn machine from the United States, and I plugged it in without understanding what was going on to the wrong voltage, and it broke down. So it's to be expected. You give it too much, it can't deal with it, it breaks down. But the truth is, that's not really the complete story. Because there was a world that emerged before the world from whence the breakdown emerged. And that world is called the world of Akudim. Okay, the world of Akudim. And the word Akud means to be bound up. Okay. And really, the reason why I didn't mention much about the world of Akudim is because nothing really happened from the world of Akudim. There was the beginning of vessel, but the 10 vessels merged in such a manner that there was no distinction between them at all. And really, just nothing emerges out of that world. So therefore, it's not really spoken about. This world of Akudim. What then emerges after the world of Akudim, which just finds itself at a standstill, it can't go anywhere, then emerges the world called Nikudim, the world of points. Nikudim. Akudim means to be bound up completely, like the word Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac. Everything's so completely bound up with each other, nothing happened. But then there's another world called the world of Nikudim, the world of points. Each vessel was a very distinct, clear point. And it was in that world that when the divine offered His light, these vessels broke down. Okay, remember, this is a metaphor upon which so much of Jewish philosophy is really drawn from, whether people are aware of it or not, but these are really the fundamental principles from which so much of Jewish philosophy and lifestyle is based. The world of Nikudim breaks down. But even though the world of Nikudim breaks down, it's from the breakdown that emerges the possibility of tikkun, fixing. Something can be fixed. I mean, something breaks down. You know, it's a very beautiful principle. Rav Nachman of Breslov was known to say that if you can break, realize that you could also fix. Most people are aware of the ability to break. Right? But if you can break it, you've got that kind of power, you can fix it. So it was from this world where there was a breakdown that there's a possibility for tikkun, and the ideal world that we are going towards is called the world of Berudim. And the world of Berudim, by the way, these words are reflected in the story of Jacob and sheep. He had this whole deal with Lavan, his father-in-law, and they have these various names, and the Zohar takes off over here because it's alluding to these ideas. There's something called Berudim, and Berudim is like a zebra. Right? That's what it looks like, Berudim. Right? Meaning that Berudim is the unification of the world of Akudim, where everything is so completely one, and the world of Nikudim, where everything is so completely separate. That's the unification, that's the ultimate fixing, that's the world that we aspire towards. Now what does all this mean? Philosophically, psychologically? In many ways, this expresses a fundamental dilemma that human beings live with. Fundamental dilemma that I'm sure we all live with. Sometimes we go a little more to the right, sometimes a little more to the left. But ultimately, there is a very serious struggle in terms of how one defines themselves, how one finds themselves, and understand the nature of their existence. And there are two poles pulling at us, two completely different directions that we feel like going, and some of us go a little more this way, some of us go a little more that way, and some of us at different times in our lives are this way or that way. The goal is to be balanced, to bring it all together. Now, the world of Akudim and the world of Nikudim represent two world philosophies. One philosophy based on a complete desire for nullification of self. The vessels in the world of Akudim didn't get anywhere because they wanted the oneness of God. They wanted the closeness with God. And they felt the only way to do that is to jump back into the light from whence they came. To completely nullify themselves. To return back. When children are born, they are born with a sense of an undifferentiated world. Children don't know the difference between their voice and the world's voice. I mean, babies. So they say, I don't know who can say that, but the scientists and psychologists are saying this. That the baby, when a baby cries, the baby thinks the whole world is crying. And I can only say, watching my own baby, he doesn't seem to know it's his hand. Right? All of a sudden, he'll be like playing, and then his hand, and, right? And he looks at his hand, and he, right? And like for him, it's unbelievable. Because he doesn't know, this is my hand, this is the world's hand. Everything is completely one and unified. There's no sense of differentiation. And of course, in terms of a regression, certain people do not grow up and they try to go back into the womb. They want to merge back into the comforting experience of completely absorbed back into the original space from whence they came, their mother. And that would, of course, be considered some kind of psychological disorder. There's something wrong, they're not willing to grow up. They cannot distinguish between what's mine, what's yours, what's me, what's the world. But you have to understand this is a very deep drive. Because there is a desire, there is a yearning to return to the oneness from whence we came. And the question is, do we return to that oneness through dissolving all the distinctions and all the separations that are apparently in my life? I don't want it. So I want to be absorbed back into some kind of original light. I want to forget there's differences. I want to forget there's an I, there's a you, there's a we, there's just a nothingness. Return back to the light. The world of Akudim went nowhere. Whereas the world of Nikudim is a world of points. Each vessel was so clear, so defined, so self-contained, it is a world of complete self, a world which is completely yearning for individuality. So I want to develop these two worlds. The world, the approach of nullification of self as a mode of seeking the one, and the mode of self-fulfillment, self-actualization, individuality as a mode, as an avenue to the encountering the oneness, but at this point it would be the oneness of me. But it was some kind of feeling of there's oneness. So I'd like to start with the world of Nicodem. It's an easier world to appreciate. And then I would like to go backwards and then deal with the dilemma. There is no doubt that one of the fundamental drives of a human being is to develop their individuality. There's no doubt. Right? That's just the facts of life. It is overwhelming to watch a child grow, because the most important thing for that child is to reach a state of self. That's what's really to see. I need to just share with you again my own personal experience when I was a baby. Now, when I'm watching my child, I mean, it's unbelievable the determination to want to prop up on his own and look at the world. Right? And there is something going on. It's no accident that we're born lying down. And then there's such a drive of life that pushes us forward to want to kind of like prop ourselves up and look at the world from a vertical point of view rather than a horizontal point of view. And then to crawl. I mean, it's unbelievable the determination of life at the very early stages to want to express and say, I am here. This is me. And then to finally stand up, to walk without any help. It's unbelievable. I mean, there are times with my second to oldest son, second to youngest son, that there are times where if I help him, he'll scream so much until we will take the steps back. We have to go back. My wife and I helped him the other day down the stairs. He didn't want to do it that way. He wanted to go by himself. So we said, okay, you'll do the next set of stairs by yourself. He cried. Come on, what's the difference? There's so many more steps to the end of the coattail, you have to understand. We're going down the stairs of the coattail. It was the first set of stairs, and he's crying his eyes out. He wants to do it by himself. It's okay, we're sorry, we didn't know. We thought, right? We had to go back up the stairs and walk down again. It's just self. Right? And of course, the most important word that a child learns as they're growing up, although I'm trying my best to teach him Abba, 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 right? First thing they'll say is no, no. Right? That's the first word that many children learn, and that's like the most important word, to be able to express their sense of self. It's an amazing drive. It's an amazing drive to establish myself and say, I am an individual. I'm really unique, I'm very special. And it continues on and on and on. This sense of possession, this is mine. The sense of, this is my name, this is my talent, this is who I am. I think I once shared with you, they picked up a fellow from the coattail. They asked him what time it was, and before he knew it, he was talking to a rabbi. And they brought him to me. And I asked him, what do you do? And he says, he's a movie star. I was supposed to be at that moment overwhelmed and humbled, but I never heard of him. So it was a little uncomfortable for him. And he was talking about this big movie that he's doing in Israel. I'm not going to tell you what it is, because then you might know who this is. But it was a very big movie, and he had a very serious role in this movie. And so I asked him, is that your original name? Because I know that a lot of stars, actors and actresses change their name. Is that your original name? And I understand. He says, no, I changed my name. Now let's, for sake of communication, let's say the fellow's name was Stein. Okay, Stein. And I said, Stein? What kind of name is Stein? I mean, if you're going to change your name to an actor's type of name. So what was your original name? So he says his name was Steinman. I said, that's not such a big change. I said, with such a little change, why did you change it at all? So I kept trying to evade the question, and I didn't understand why, and I kept kind of pushing it. So finally he got a little upset, And he said, because I didn't want to get this job because of my dad. Oh, okay. So who's your dad? Right. So before he answers the question, he starts to tell me how he struggled on Off-Broadway, acting schools, little parts, this and that. I really worked it up, and then I went on. And I said, who's your dad? And I went, well, ABC, and then I did. I said, who's your dad? His dad was the president of either ABC or NBC or something like that. And I'm sure nobody knows who this guy is, that he's the son of. And it's like incredible. Like this need to show that there is me, I'm very unique, I did it on my own. You know, there's a phenomenon that I think a lot of people can appreciate. You walk into someone's house, and they offer you a drink. And even though your tongue is as dry as the Sahara Desert, you say, oh, no, thank you. No, thank you. You're dying for a drink, right? You're dying for a drink. No, no, I'm really not thirsty. I had a drink a couple years ago. It's fine. Well, maybe a piece of cake. Please, please. You're in my house. Please, a piece of cake. Oh, no, no, no. No, thank you, really. No, no, I'm really full. I mean, 10 years ago I had a piece of cake. Oh, but now you don't understand why, and you keep saying, you're crazy. You're starving. Why didn't you say yes? Why was it that your first initial reaction was to say, no, no, thank you. Oh, no, no. Well, you really want it. And now you're stuck. Right? But thank God they continue on. So, oh, no, 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 please have a piece of cake. Oh, no, I really couldn't. Oh, please, I can't let someone in my house without eating something. No, no, really, I'm just not hungry. And then they say to you, do me a favor. Do me a favor. A piece of cake. All of a sudden, something has transformed, and you can say, oh, okay, fine, oh, sure, yeah, well, yeah, okay. Then what happened? Right? All of a sudden, you're doing them a favor. Right? By receiving it, you are giving them the opportunity to give it to you. People, for some reason, don't like to receive. Because to receive implies a certain dependence. Right? And there's such a deep drive to express, to establish my independence, that to accept something for nothing seems to conflict with this drive of selfhood. But if the person says, do me a favor, as crazy as it sounds, right? But do me a favor. Say, okay, I'll do you a favor. I'll give to you. And I'll eat the piece of cake. So, there is this very interesting drive and need for individuality. And you know, we talked about it before. The Zohar says that the first place where the evil inclination gets us is in our hair and in our clothing. Right? What does it mean, hair and clothing? What is hair and clothing? Hair and clothing is my individuality. It's the first place that I apparently express my individuality. Of course, there's a much more authentic place from whence individuality should be expressed. But in terms of the superficial, the tangible, it's our hair and it's our clothing. People will spend incredible amounts of money to have that hairdo that nobody else had. Or that dress that nobody else has, a sense of original designs. Right? Original designs. And wouldn't it be absolutely embarrassing to walk into this great ballroom after spending weeks looking for that right dress or that right suit, and you walk in and lo and behold, you can't believe it, there were three other people with the same dress, the same suit, right? What do you care? There was a sale. What do you expect, right? No. That sense of exclusively me is such a fundamental drive. And remember, I was walking down Ben Yehuda. I saw this fellow walking down. He had this the most outlandish haircut I ever saw. More outlandish than my own. And he had like his completely cut around here with, I thought it was a kippah, but it was just a thick of hair. And he had this leather vest with at least maybe 500 different pins of, I don't know, various pins from all over the world that he designed in terms of some kind of interesting order. And he had these high leather boots. We're talking about a hot summer night. And he had his hand inside like this with a cigarette like this. And he walked up and down Ben Yehuda. Basically saying, look at me! Somebody look at me! Right? And it worked. I mean, people did look at him and laughed, but people looked at him anyways. There's this incredible need to say, this is me. This is my individuality. I want to be unique. I want to be special. It's drawn from the world of Nikudim. It's drawn from the world of points. Because in the world of points, the vessel wanted all the light. Each vessel thought it could possess the light, completely absorb it. To the point that I am number one. I am the Almighty. I am omnipotent, completely unique. There is this attempt for the finite to absorb the infinite. And in so doing, think that maybe we are the infinite. I would say to a certain extent, this is expressed in a fundamental way through technology. Because what really is technology? Its fundamental theme, capturing the limitations of time and space. I think if we were trying to figure out, well, what's the theme of technology? What would it mean that we have technologically advanced in terms of the popular understandings? As I mentioned to you many times, you know, in Jerusalem, you get a chance to see the world come through every day. The world is walking through here. And so maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I would see people with these video machines, these heavy, uncomfortable machines with this trolley, you know, that they schlep alongside and this heavy camera. And you wonder how they could really enjoy their trip with this on there. But okay. But about a year later, people are walking through Jerusalem with videos, and now it's much smaller and it's on a backpack. And then 6 months later, it's a, you know, shoulder bag with a smaller video. And every year the video becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And I'm sure in about 10 years from now, people will point their fingers and it will be in their thumbnail or in their fingernail. They'll put the video in there and they'll put the cartridge in and they'll go... And we will say, great, we've advanced, look how far we've come. Right? Because the video is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, we are somehow capturing, going beyond the limitations of time and space. We're in control of space. And in terms of time, the same thing. You know, once upon a time, to cook some meal, it's a couple of hours, you know, just to get the wood. But then, advance, you plug it in, advanced, put it into a microwave oven and 3 minutes or 10 minutes, cooked. And we say, fantastic, we're moving forward in life. Right? It took us 3 hours to make a steak, now it takes 5 minutes to make a steak, 2 minutes, 1 minute, you put it in, and we say, oh. To a certain extent, I think perhaps technology's fundamental theme is, how can we absorb all the light? How can I, the finite, absorb infinite potential, infinite power? But that's the side of self, and that's a very serious drive that we all have in terms of who am I, what am I, what uniquely makes me, what's special about me. And to explore, to demonstrate, and to portray the fact that not only is there not another human being with the same thumbprint in the world, itself is amazing, but there's not another human being in the world that's like me. I'm unique, I'm individual. Of course, that can become a very heavy ego, that can become very, very dangerous, that can be very, very destructive, to the point that I think I am God, and I ultimately want to dethrone any notion of a God that I must answer to, because the infinite completely fills me. The infinite is completely and totally imminent within me. And that's one approach. And that, to its ultimate extent, is the snake's approach in the Garden of Eden. Because the Garden of Eden, the snake is saying, you can be like God. And God doesn't want competition. You can be a God, ultimately, yourself. But then there's a whole other side, a whole other tension. there is some very strange need and yearning for nullification. I want to just jump right back to some primordial reality. I want to jump back into the womb of my mother. I want to jump back into the undifferentiated reality. I think we can understand self-nullification in three modes. The first and most apparent mode is there is, on one hand, a great desire to nullify ego. As much as there is this incredible urge to solidify my ego, on the other hand, there is this drive, there's this pull to let go of my ego. Let go of my ego completely. And I would say in certain terms of maybe the popular understandings of love expresses that. This kind of letting go. I'm in love, your wish is my command. I can't get that person out of my mind. I'm completely surrender myself to you. And there's some relieving pleasure in the surrendering of that ego in the experience of falling in love. This feeling, take me, I'm yours. You've got me around your little finger. And like people sing about this, but there's something that's very beautiful about it for some people. Of course, when it's out of balance, it's very dangerous. But we're looking at the various polarities that are happening in our lives. On another note, as much as people would like to express themselves and be very unique, to say I'm different, there's a whole other side where people want to conform. Right? People want to dress very similar. They once interviewed a girl in New York, and she was dressed like Madonna. And they asked her, why are you dressed like this? And she said, to express my individuality. And she was serious. There is this need to conform. There's on one hand a need to stick out. On the same hand, we have this need to not stick out at all. To just kind of melt into the sea of everythingness. It's a very strange thing. On one hand, everything from within keeps telling me I'm something. And yet everything without tells me I'm nothing, and I want to know that too. And there is this very uplifting, rejoicing feeling to be next to the Grand Canyon. And just to realize how nothing I am. There's some great joy in my knees starting to knock when I appreciate how but a speck of dust I truly am. And many people want to go into a little rubber dinghy and kind of like go off into the middle of the ocean and once again awaken within themselves that realization, I'm no more than a drop. And there's that other side that's just so relieving, just so beautiful to just be in the midst of that great scene and just completely be nullified to it. I think on a more holy note, not as if that's not holy, but in a more constructive way, there's a real desire to share, to give, to build families, and that certainly, sometimes it could be an expression of ego, but sometimes it could be an expression of wanting to let go of my ego. But then there's a next level. I not only want to nullify my ego, I want to nullify my choice. I want to nullify my choice. And I think people know this in what's called the creative experience. Because in the creative experience, what the artist or the musician is waiting for is that ability where it just happened. I didn't make it happen. I just let it happen. It just came through me. I was sitting there and I wanted to write a poem, but I can't do it. I just can't write this poem. I don't know, it's just not happening. Right? And yet you know that you've got to start, you've got to put your pen on the paper, and somehow the first few words are very difficult, and all of a sudden, beyond your control, something hits you, and you become almost under the influence of a higher force. And before you know it, maybe 5 hours went by, and you're madly writing, and it's there. It's finished. And you're in complete awe. You don't know where it came from. But there's some great pleasure in that. Artists know this. You know, an artist sits in front of their easel and canvas. What am I going to paint? I don't know. What are they waiting for? Inspiration. Where do you get it from? Right. Turn it on. You got to humble yourself. You got to nullify yourself. You've got to recognize, did I really think I was the source of creativity in the world? No. No, and I just sit there. It's amazing if you speak to some artists. There's this amazing sense of lack of confidence every time they're about to do their next painting. This realization, like, they call you Picasso. You did those. I did that. I don't believe I did that. And you just start saying, you really harden yourself, I can't paint, I don't even know, it was just luck, I don't know where it came from. I mean, sure, I painted 10 paintings, but now, could I really do the 11th painting? Nah, it wasn't me. It's an amazing thing, where you start realizing, it wasn't me, what am I, nothing. I think I can paint. And yet, they asked Bob Dylan, how do you write songs? Bob Dylan said, I put my pen on the paper, and I know it's going to be all right. See that? Faith. It's the sense of a higher being that controls the world, that directs the world, and I must surrender myself. And so too with the musicians. I'm about to write a song. I'm writing the song. I wrote a song. Could I write a song? And you know, you have to put your fingers on the piano and you've got to just start. And the start is so painful. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, your fingers seem to know exactly where they should go. And there's only one thing you have to do. Get out of the way. It's the only thing you've got to do. Get out of the way. Let it come through you. Let it happen. And this is the moment the creative people are waiting for. I know personally in writing music, there are times I sit down and I just start playing this note and that note, and all of a sudden, I don't know where it's coming from, but my fingers seem to know. And very often my wife would come out, bedroom, whatever, and say, what is that? And I would just say, I don't know. I don't know. But I just won't get involved, and hopefully it'll continue. It's an amazing experience. The creative experience. It's really a very deep understanding that there is a force beyond myself. And that I just want to surrender completely, nullify myself completely, and be a completely transparent vessel for that to be revealed in the world. You know? And I would say many great artists would never feel comfortable to say they painted it. In fact, they asked famous director, what's his name, Ingmar Bergman, they asked him, how do you direct films? And he said, direct films? How do you make films? Make films. I don't direct films and I don't make films. Films make me. Films direct me. It's a very amazing experience that the creative people understand. Right? And everybody, I'm sure, in their own way have had that creative experience where it's coming through. And that's what we're waiting for. It's an amazing experience. So when the musician gets on stage, and if he says, it's me, it's my song, it's my guitar, it's my fingers, and you all came to see me. Not a chance, it won't work. The musician has to all of a sudden go into such a state of humbleness. Such a state of like, just like a, it's almost a service to what they don't know, but some of them might know. And they get on stage and they've got to let go. They can't be self-conscious. If you're self-conscious on stage, you lose it. You've got to let go completely. Let go completely, and it comes through you. And all of a sudden, the band starts to move like an organism. All of a sudden, the band starts to move like one hand. And there's a communication that goes beyond talking. You know exactly when to start. You know exactly when to stop. You don't know where it's coming from. But you know it's not coming from you. And at the point where you think it is coming from you, that's when it all breaks down. And I can only say from my own experience doing concerts, I would get on stage, and you know, I'm in an even more difficult situation, because I don't know how to read notes. I don't read music. I write through ear, through spontaneity, inspiration, but I can't write it down. So I always have to tape it. Right? I always have to try and tape it. Problem is, so many of the nigunim that I wrote were on Shabbat. and I couldn't tape it. Right? And those were the most challenging times. It wasn't yours. It wasn't yours. You got to just let go of it. Many Shabbats, I would get a nigun out of nowhere. It just hit me. Right? And I try to sing it all Shabbats. I wouldn't forget it. Right? And sure enough, Havdalah, it's gone. I say to my wife, what was that nigun we were singing? What? I don't remember. It's not yours. It's not yours. I remember one particular nigun. It was Tuesday night. I was about to doze off. And all of a sudden, na, 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 na. Hey, wake up! What's wrong, man? I ran over to tape recorder. There's no batteries in this tape recording. I went crazy. I capture it. Can't hold on to it. I just let go. And it's such a relieving experience. Just let go. What do you mean? You're nothing. You're just a vessel in the hands of the real creator. You're the guitar. God's the player. So I remember, I get on stage and I don't know, I can't read notes, so I have to remember it. And I can tell you honestly, just as I'm about to play this song that I wrote, I forget it completely. I don't even know what note it starts. I don't know anything. It's the most strangest thing. And there's a moment where you just have to let go. And there's this incredible faith, right? Where you say, get out of the way, and you just let your hands go, and they go to the right place. And you're amazed. Yourself, you're amazed. They're playing the right notes. Right? And it's just, and you know, don't get in the way. Don't get involved. Keep out of this, David. And you just have to be transcendent, outside of it. Nullified. And yet, as things are going better and better and better, you start to feel a little better with yourself. It says, hey, this is pretty good. Hey, this is a good song. Hey, wait, come back. You lose it completely. And all of a sudden, you say, let go. And finally you get back into it. It is an amazing experience. Not to be self-conscious. Something that really drives people. Right? Just completely let go. People want it. I used to teach at the Israel Center. And the Israel Center, I would teach at night. And at the other side of the room is the window. The window was closed and it was dark. And of course, in the reflection of a window, it's dark, you can see yourself very clearly. I was teaching and things were really going and it was spontaneous. And I was saying things that I never said before. And maybe I never will say again because I never said them in the first place. And it was just really coming through. And as I was speaking and it was spontaneous and I wasn't involved, it was just, I just felt I was a vessel. All of a sudden, I see this little red-headed guy, right, in the window, right, reflection of me. And I know. And I lost it. I completely lost my train of thought because I became self-conscious. All of a sudden, I realized, you're speaking, they're listening. You've got to let go. And that's such an incredible drive. People want to be controlled. People know that there's some kind of higher force. And there's a great pleasure. There's the other side. I make it happen. I'm the force. That's one side. But then there's another side. Who am I? What am I? A vessel in the hands of the Creator. I'm a guitar. But what really happens? What really happens? Well, sure, you know, the musician gets on stage and they know they've got to let go. They know they have to be so completely humble. You're not the boss. The boss is playing, not you. But then what happens, you get on stage, you know you got to let go, and you know you got to be completely humble, and you really want to just simply serve the people, you want to try and lift these people, you really want to do something holy, or you think is holy. But after the show, people come up to you and say, hey, you're great. I am? I am? Hey. Oh, you're wonderful. Oh, can I have your autograph? My autograph? I'm great? Hey, you know? I guess you're right. I mean, that was me on stage. I mean, yeah, you're right. I'm great. I'm fantastic. I'm wonderful. Oh, it's me. That boss. Look at me. And all of a sudden, from this incredible state of nullification, of surrender, of humbleness, I end up thick as a brick. I am so hard. I've got such a concrete ego. I think it was me. The whole time I realized that my greatness was because I realized a greatness that I could only serve to uplift people. And now all of a sudden, because everyone's telling me and they think it was me, and I'm saying, you're right, it's me, all of a sudden, blows me away. I had a conversation with a very, very big musician. He played with some big, big bands throughout the history of rock and roll. Now he's a religious Jew. Right. You've got to go through that to be religious. Anyways, so I was talking to him about the phenomena of musicians and their experience, and as a musician, I think I can understand. And he said, you know what drives musicians crazy? They know it's not them, but they want to believe it is them. And it's driving them nuts. Right? They really want to believe it was me that did all that. Right? It was my song, it was my music, it was my fingers, it was me. And everybody loves me. Right? And they just realize and have to realize they're nothing. If you're not a servant, if you're not serving a higher purpose and realize you were just a conduit, never happened. And so too, the artist, at the end of painting a picture, I think many artists can objectively look at it and say, that is beautiful. Who did that? It wasn't me. I don't know where it came from. I did that. I mean, you could look at it, something just took over, and in maybe 10 hours nonstop, it felt like 10 minutes. There it is, a masterpiece. And you were frightened to put your name on it. Could I put my name on it? Would I have the audacity to say, this was mine, I did this? I didn't do anything. I was just a vehicle for its revelation. And they're sitting there and they can objectively say it's beautiful without in any way being haughty about it, because they don't believe it, they did it. They feel very honored that they were part of it, that they were the paintbrush. But then someone comes up and says, did you do that painting? The person says, it's not like I didn't do that painting. Just answer the question. Did you do that painting? Well, I guess I did. I mean, yeah. So why'd you put your name on it? I mean, put my name on it? And say it was mine? Yeah, I mean, did you do it or not? I mean, Baruch Hashem. Thank God. Im Yirtzeh Hashem, with the help of God. Well, yeah, okay. So put your name on it. Right? So you put on the top of it, B'sata D'Shmaya, BSD, with the help of God, and then you put your name on the bottom. Someone else comes up to you and says, did you do that painting? Well, you say, yes, I've been studying for many, many years, but I couldn't say it wasn't with a little help of the, master of the universe. But you did do that painting. Well, yeah, I did. Now the person goes, wow, what a painting. You say, yes, you're right. Well, I've been working on it. I mean, a little inspiration here and there, but yeah, I did it. Another person comes up and says, did you do that painting? You're sure right I did. I put years into that painting. What happened? And then after all that, you stand in front of your next canvas with such confidence, I'm going to paint. I can't paint. I never painted. When did I paint? I never did it. I don't even know, who am I to put my name on these things? Are you crazy? You did it? And all of a sudden you go back into humbleness, surrender, what are you anyways? Like, let me start. Let me see. Well, 10 hours, 10 minutes. There it is again, you're odd. But the next time was harder, right? The next time, you need something to help you lose your self-consciousness. Right? This is the sad thing in terms of drugs. Because drugs is part of losing self-consciousness. Trying to get out of my ego. Trying to get out of it. Let go of it. And so when the musician got on stage the first time, he didn't need anything. The next time, maybe I need a couple beers just to loosen me up. Maybe a couple shots of whiskey to loosen me up. Maybe a couple joints to make me feel a little more comfortable. And it goes on and on and on. I gotta let go. It's a hard thing to do. The balance. But it goes even beyond that. There's not only the nullification of ego, there's this desire for the nullification of choice. I want to be controlled. I want it to come through me. I want to let go. I don't want to control this. I would like to just be moved through. There's a very high experience, a very real experience. It represents something that we also know deep down inside of ourselves. So we're sitting there in the concert, and there were a couple of yeshiva boys also in the audience. And all of a sudden, completely overwhelmed, on the other side of the stadium, a complete section stands on their chairs and starts to scream, section one, chuck, chuck, there ain't no fans like us, there ain't no fans like us. went, oh my gosh, what is going on? I mean, what is going on? And before I knew it, another section, all of them, section four, got up and started screaming, no, Chuck, 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 Chuck. I mean, if only people would say with such kavana, such intention, amen to someone's prayer. I mean, it was like, wow, you know. And all the section were going, I was saying to my wife, we are not standing up. We belong to the world of Nikudim, sweetheart. We are in the world of point. Who's checking? Who is this guy? Everyone's getting up, and I saw the section beside me. I couldn't believe it. A row of yeshiva boys got up on their chairs and are screaming, Chuck, Chuck, Chuck. I'd love to see how they learn Talmud, these guys. I mean, you know, no, we're fans like us. There ain't no fans like us. Hashem, Hashem. Anyways. And then our section got up, and boy, did we feel stupid. We're the only ones sitting down say, there are other fans other than us, Chuck. There's this feeling of like, let go, I want to be part of the whole, and we're just like beating out, like nullifying. And particularly, this is part of the experience of what I think is so attractive to the rock concerts. Because what happens in this rock concert? What is really going on? What do I want? It's very simple. The sages say, give me the beat boy and free my soul. I want to get off on your rock and roll. Drift away. Just drift away. Just take me. I'm yours. Right? You're the gods. You can take me wherever you want to take me. I want to let go. And it's the weirdest thing. It's coming from a place that if it was directed, what service, what humbleness, what that could do to the world. It's taken to the wrong place, the beat boy. It's going in the wrong direction, but I want to be uplifted. I want to let go. I don't want to be bound to this body anymore. I just want to merge. And then all of a sudden, you just don't feel like they're playing, we're listening. You just feel like there's such a unity here. You feel like something is real here. You feel that something's portrayed here that is really the essence of life. And all of a sudden you look around, thousands and thousands of people in the stadium, and they're all holding a match. Everyone's holding a little match. And like all of us, everyone's holding a little match. And there's plenty of lighting in the stadium. But everyone's holding a little match, right? And you say, oh, got a match? Hey, got a match? I need a match, I need a match. Right? And everyone's, right? Got a match? Come on, I need a match. Someone gives you a match, go... Right? And what do you care to have a little match so you can be one little flame amongst thousands of flames, and you feel so relieved, you feel so liberated, and as the match comes closer to your finger, you say, hey guys, what's going on? Hey come on, you realize they're all holding. What are they holding? Lighters. Right. You're so stupid. Right? You're holding a match. Right? With only temporal nullification. Temporal nullification. But you want to feel like just a little flame. Completely, completely nullified. To some greater flame. It's a very real experience. A very important experience. If it was directed in the right areas. But then... it goes beyond that, because people know that if I could find that ideal that would be worth dying for, that's an ideal worth living for. Now, does that make sense? That makes sense. And yes, it really does make sense, because it portrays an inner awareness that my sense of self is not self-contained, and that I'm bound up with a greater reality. And my surrender to that greater reality is in a real way an expression of a higher self. I think I might have once told you, I'll read to you, as you can see this is getting older and older, this is John Glenn, I'm sure one of your favorites, right? Who is John Glenn? Right. Friendship 7 Flight. So they were interviewing John Glenn, and this was after the explosion of the space shuttle Challenger. And this brought back memories for John Glenn of his own fears when his heat shield apparently was ripping off and he thought he was about to die as Friendship 7 was returning to Earth. And so they asked him, how did you feel? And he said, Glenn told his family before the flight that people don't live until they devote themselves to a purpose greater than they are. You feel a responsibility to that purpose that transcends your own safety. Interesting. Why? Right? What happened to the world of points? What happened to the self? And yet there's a real side to us that knows the beauty, the fulfillment of letting go. So we find ourselves in the middle of a real serious dilemma. Two sides pulling us. One side says, establish yourself, make a name for yourself, be special, be unique, find your identity, find your individuality, and say, this is who I am, and make it happen. Control. You find I could absorb the infinite light. But then there's this other side that says, who do you think you are? You're just 1/5 billionth of a speck of dust. You really think you're something? Nullify yourself. Surrender yourself. Recognize how little you are. Humble yourself. Throw yourself back into the infinite light. They should know these two approaches, in many ways, find themselves expressed in different religions. But Judaism, I believe, unifies these two approaches into an approach which is healthy. Because the world of selfhood is the world where a person becomes neurotic and they think, it's all in my hands, as if I'm God. But the world of self-nullification, it's all in God's hands, it's all in someone else's hands, it's not in my hands at all. I'm nothing, what can I do? And Judaism is the balance. Judaism, as we mentioned, was Yaakov Avinu. And Yaakov had to absorb the Esav-like power, the technology of Esav. Esav, that hairy fellow. Esav, that person who looked complete. They called him Esav because he looked complete. He looked like a fully grown man. Esav, who was that person who thought there's really just me. But Yaakov absorbs. Yaakov sits in tents. Yaakov is nullified to the world of Word of God, the teachings of Torah. But Yaakov has to balance himself out. And Yaakov is going to have to draw into himself the blessings of Esav. And as we mentioned before when we learned that, why didn't God tell Isaac that Yaakov is standing before him rather than Esav? The Zohar says, certainly the Shekhinah could have told Isaac what's going on. But the Zohar says that God wanted Isaac to bless Jacob with the blessings of Esav. The blessings of Esav. The blessings of Esav is that power, that nikudim, that power of self, that power of determination, but it comes to be selfish, egotistical, exclusive, and ultimately disastrous. Rav Kook has a very amazing, amazing piece. He talks about the souls from the world of Tohu. The world of Tohu is the world of the points. And in our generation, and in every generation, there is born into our world a soul from the world of Tohu. And Rav Kook says, these souls, if not controlled and guarded, will destroy the world. There are souls that come in the world that are so powerful, so convinced that they absorbed all that light, that they really think they're God. They really think they can control it. You know, when you read history, Alexander the Great, you get a little nervous. It's shocking that people could even think that they could get where they thought they wanted to go. It's frightening that people like that. Certainly, without mentioning Adolf, these are souls from Tohu. But Rav Kook says, these souls, if they could be fixed, what godliness they could really bring in the world. And so do we believe that Esav could have done tshuva. And that's what Yitzchak believed. He thought if Esav could do tshuva, wow! What we would have here is a gibor lifnei Hashem. A person who has established their sense of self in a manner that they could have a relationship with God. And a relationship is the unification of two opposing forces, the maintenance of identity and yet the nullification to the other. It has to be that balance. It has to be that balance. So the Leshem, who is the grandfather of Eliyashiv, who is considered one of the Torah giants of our generation, his grandfather was a great Kabbalist. And he says that just as much as the evil must meet the righteous must meet the evil. And he explains that Moshe Rabbeinu had to face Pharaoh. Because two worlds. Because you know what Moshe Rabbeinu said about himself? Mani, what am I? Moshe was on such a high level of nullification to God. Complete surrender. And yet God says to Moses, you go to Pharaoh. All people, you're going to send a fellow like Moses to Pharaoh? And Moses has a stutter. He says, me? To Pharaoh? And who is Pharaoh? God. Pharaoh thinks he's God. So as Moses belongs to a certain extent from the world of Akudim to surrender to God, this complete nullification, he must meet Pharaoh, who is the Nikudim. He absorbs all the light. He thinks he's God. And you know, when Moses came to Pharaoh, Pharaoh said, who sent you? Moses said, Yudke Babke. The transcendental God to whom next to we are all nothing. Pharaoh cringed every time he heard that name. And they say that, he said, I never heard of such a God. Get away from me. Right? He'd ask his aides, get me the God directory. See if that name's in any, I don't know. Pharaoh believed in Elohim. God fills me. Many gods. Elohim Acherim. But Yudke Vavke. The transcendental God. You're void of any godliness. Who do you think you are? Never heard. And that was again the unification. The balance is what Jews are interested in. A Jew has a responsibility to develop themselves, to focus in on their unique talents, to love God b'chol me'udecha. One of the understandings of loving God with all your me'udecha is loving God with all your might, your particular might, your unique talent. You have to understand who you are. I have to be confident and say, this is who I am, this is what I can do. Humbleness does not mean you think you're nothing. You think you're nothing. Humbleness means, I know I have power, I know I have strength, it's a gift from God. Huh? That's a humble person. Huh? It's a facade to pretend you're humble. Oh, I'm really not this, I'm really not that, I'm really not this. Person also has to simultaneously understand what they are and what they can do. You've got to believe that you can fix the world. You can fix yourself. You can do tshuva. You can do something. You have power. You have strength. You have control. You have discipline. And there is individuality to you. But you can't let that over-evolve to begin to think that you have all the power. To think that you must be completely in control. To think that you're going to make it happen, and only you're going to make it happen. And let that evolve into just this hard ego that suggests that I'm self-contained, self-complete, self-defined. So you got to nullify. In Judaism, yes, there is a notion of surrender. Yes, there is a notion of incredible humility and humbleness. And to recognize your nothingness. What do you think you are anyway? But what are you nullifying? The klipa, the hard shell, the hard ego. That illusion that tells me I'm everything. The illusion that tells me I'm separate, self-defined, I'm complete. Gotta nullify all that. But not to the point that you've nullified any sense of self-esteem, confidence. Judaism is this balance. Judaism says there are do's, you can do something, and there are don'ts. You've got to surrender. And be willing to accept the will of God. And Judaism is such an unusual religion, I think, because to say to a person, you know what? Here's a mitzvah. What is it? Take two candles and light them. And you have done something of cosmic significance. Do you know how much you have to believe in yourself to do that? To really think that I'm going to take two candles worth a couple pennies, light it, make a blessing and say, God commanded me to light this. You're crazy. You think God cares whether I light a candle or not? You really think that I'm significant enough that God would even care to command me to light a candle, let alone think that when I did it, I really did something that had any meaning in the world? You know, it takes a lot of self-confidence. And yet, on the other hand, there's certain things that I would really like to do. Right? As it says in the oral tradition, a person shouldn't say, I don't like the taste of pig. It doesn't interest me. I love the taste of pig. I'm sure I would really enjoy it. I want it, but I choose not to because God has decreed I nullify myself. I accept the ruler beyond myself. It's a balance. It's a balance in our lives. A human being has to be able to stand on their two feet, have to have the confidence of an Abraham. The confidence that Abraham developed to know that I shall be unto you an Elohim, close to you, imminent. I give to you that kind of power to make it happen in the world, Avraham Avinu. You can make a covenant with God. You can pray to God. You can say, will the judge of the world not do justice? Yes, I give you that power, man, to stand before me. And yet, you have to have the surrender of Isaac. Because remember, we learned that Abraham, God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, according to some of the commentators. And Abram chose to do God's will. It wasn't a decree, it was a request. And Abram said, yes. It was a choice. However, for Isaac, it wasn't a choice, it was a decree. And he accepted it. He surrendered. Completely surrendered. And of course, the balance. Kabbalistically, Abraham is associated with the right hand. The right hand makes it happen. Powerful. But Isaac is associated with the left hand. The accepting, the surrendering. But Jacob is the unification of the two worlds. Where he has that humbleness, that humility, that nullification, that surrender, and yet still has that sense of confidence and power, that sense of responsibility. So the world of Akudim is a world where people nullify, and it didn't go anywhere. The world of Nikudim was individuality to the point that I think I'm everything and I want to have all the light and you break down. But the fixing will be through a very careful integration between developing the self-confidence with the utmost sense of surrender. And with this balance, we will succeed in walking across that very narrow bridge.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.